At one point near the end of this Egyptian shopping spree, it occurred to Avrakatos that no other CIA officer had been able to play such a hand as he was in the campaign against America's great enemy, and all because of this Texas congressman. As far as he was concerned, Charlie Wilson was a partner he could go the course with. Wilson had not only passed Gust's ethics test, he had demonstrated that he could be more valuable to the agency in dealing with Egypt than anyone else in the U.S. government. What we did in 1 month with Charlie would have taken us 9 years to accomplish. Gust would learn to operate in Egypt without Wilson's presence. With Charlie's blessing, Avrakatos would deal with low-level problems by telling whatever Egyptian blocker might be in his way that Congressman Wilson had already spoken to the defense minister about the matter, and perhaps the officer would like to call Abu Razala if he insisted on overriding the field marshal's wishes. This was Gust's old game of bureaucratic chicken, and as long as he was moving under the mantle of the magical congressman, the keys to the Egyptian kingdom were his. But frequently in those early months, Avrakatos had to call on Wilson to intervene directly. Thanks to Charlie, Gust was able to build his own storage facilities at Port Suez, and then send Egyptians to the United States for training as production inspectors. Once, Wilson decided that a major crisis over quality control was too big to be dealt with by phone, so he invited Mohammed for a weekend at the Hawkeye Lodge, a good old boy establishment in the Pine Woods of East Texas, where legendary Texans like John Connolly, Nelson Bunker Hunt, and Ross Perot go for rest and recreation. It's a place where a man can ride, shoot skeet, hunt, fish, and hang out and drink with the boys. It's expensive, but Charlie arranged to have some of the defense contractors who sell their wares to the Egyptian military pick up the tab. And, for icing on the cake, he thoughtfully summoned Carol Shannon, his personal belly dancer, whom Mohammed so adored, to come for the weekend with her entire troupe of liberated Fort Worth belly-dancing housewives. There is a tradition at retreats like Hawkeye that no one talks about the recreation pursued on these visits, so before the festivities began, Gust took Mohammed aside and said there would be no wiretaps, no photographs, his word of honor. This was to be a weekend of pure, free play. The two men instinctively understood each other. Mohammed, coming from a land of intrigue and omnipresent dangers, did Gust the singular compliment of taking him unreservedly at his word. So, with Secret Servicemen and local police patrolling the wooded perimeter, Carol danced, Charlie drank, Mohammed entertained everyone with his endless store of ethnic jokes, and Gust resolved his problems. As always, it was wonderful fun doing business Charlie's way. Before his tour of duty was over, Gust would place orders for tens of millions of dollars worth of weapons. The consignments grew so large that he bought a special ship to move them in containers to Karachi. For the next 2 years, he was treated like a visiting monarch whenever he went to Egypt, and because of his expanding business with the Chinese, he was in the catbird seat when it came to organizing competitive bidding. Avrakatos was able to drive prices down to half the going black market rate. On one occasion, Mohammed's trusted General Yahya whined, "We're only making half a cent a round. I'd like to make more." "Well, I'd like to fuck Marilyn Monroe, but she's dead," Avrakatos responded. "Take the money and be happy." After brooding for 3 weeks, the Egyptians folded. By the end of this first trip to Egypt, Gust had come to feel that he was poised to provide a steady stream of weaponry at a predictable price, without fear of any sudden cutoffs. This was critical to everything that Mike Vickers was teaching Gust about the weapons policy the CIA must pursue. There was one lurking concern that Gust could never quite shake, the threat posed by Islamic extremists. Once, while being driven through Cairo by an Egyptian officer, he came upon an entire block that had recently been burned to the ground. Demanding that the car stop, he got out and learned that the Egyptian security forces had wiped out the entire neighborhood because it was thought to harbor radicals. Cairo's politics were clearly unpredictable, which meant that Abu Razala's hold might not last forever. But for the time being, Gust figured Mohammed was firmly in control of the armed forces, and that meant things couldn't be better for the CIA. For Wilson, the Egyptian trip was a small rite of passage. He had now been introduced into the CIA's clandestine services. Beyond that, he had gone through a dramatic learning experience. "Up until that time, I thought we just needed to buy the guns and get them into Afghanistan," he says. But in Egypt, he had been sobered, witnessing how one weapon after another that he had wanted Gust to buy sight unseen proved to be worthless. Furthermore, Charlie had learned that it didn't help to put guns in the field if you didn't have a proper supply of ammunition to feed them and a pipeline to get that ammunition to the fighters. One thing that had not changed was Wilson's spirit, still completely untamable when it came to conniving for his freedom fighters. Gust had told Wilson that the CIA was running a Muslim jihad and he would not buy weapons from the Israelis. But Jerusalem was Charlie's next stop on his trip with Trish, and once in the Israeli capital, he and Zvi went back to work scheming to get the Charlie horse into the Afghan war. By the time Wilson arrived, the Israelis had come up with an ingenious argument as to why their anti-aircraft gun would be more effective and cheaper than anything else the agency could acquire. It was to be fed by 2.75-inch rockets, and Zvi's people at Israeli Military Industries were convinced that the U.S. Army had vast stocks of such ammunition left over from the Vietnam War. If Wilson could tap into this treasure trove and acquire the ammunition for free as surplus, the Israeli gun would cost the CIA precious little to operate, and IMI, for its part, could disguise it as a Soviet weapon or anything else for that matter. As always, Wilson was scheming on many fronts, but looking like nothing more than the ultimate boondoggling congressman. From Israel, he took Trish to Marrakech, where they checked into the Churchill suite at La Mamounia Hotel. Charlie, of course, dropped in on the highest military command to justify the U.S. government picking up the tab. With the CIA on board and the Egyptian arsenal now open, Charlie could feel the tide turning. For Gustav Rakatos, Cairo was hopeful right up until the very last hours when, without Wilson by his side, he ran into the horror of dealing with the Egyptians as a mere mortal. A single parent, he was rushing to catch the last plane back to Washington that would get him home for Thanksgiving dinner with his son Gregory, but there was the usual bottleneck at customs. Almost a decade later, a CIA friend would tell Gregory the story of what he saw in the airport that day. The Greek-American with the bushy mustache, wearing blue jeans and a dark blue jacket, leapt into the baggage area and started hurling suitcases about until he found his, then bolted toward the gate. Grabbed by security guards, he brandished his diplomatic passport, roaring at them to call Abu Razala. It was one of those borderline situations where a security official might go either way, either be intimidated or believe that he had just apprehended a true terrorist. Choosing the bureaucrat's route, the Egyptians put in the call and watched with amazement as Avrakatos dressed down Mohammed's aide, growling that the aide had exactly 4 minutes to get him moving toward the plane. Otherwise, the field marshal should be informed that the CIA was not buying anything more from Egypt. When last seen, Gust was not only on the plane jetting back for his turkey dinner, but had been elevated to first class, compliments of the Egyptian Ministry of Defense.